last case, 06613 and 614, we're pleased to have sitting in place of Justice Resnick, Judge Alan Travis, who's the Judge of the Court of Appeals, sitting in the 10th Appellate District. Welcome, Judge Travis. Mr. Happeny.
May it please the court, my name is Randy Happeny, and I'll be arguing on behalf of the appellants. The appellants are Rob Walters, the adoptive father in this case, and William Wright, the biological father. This case is before the court on certified conflict regarding a notice issue regarding the best interest of a child in an adoption case. There was also a discretionary appeal allowed with regard to the constitutionality of Revised Code Section 3107.16. There was a separate request for a discretionary appeal on the underlying notice issues, which the court did not allow. The case was initiated on behalf of Mr. Walters by the filing of a 60B motion to vacate an adoption on the basis that the service on the biological father was defective. The biological father joined in that motion with an affidavit and subsequently was joined in the case as a co-movement at the time of the hearing, which was originally held in April of 2004. The father, the biological father, is from Bessemer, Alabama, and was here, received notice of that litigation through my office. He's represented by Mr. Zeigen.
This is a rather strange alliance. I assume the adoptive father wants, I understand he's divorced now or getting divorced?
There is a divorce case pending, Your Honor.
And his, assuming his motivation is to get out of child support payments by doing
so? Your Honor,
so?
What happened in that respect was I represent Mr. Walters in the divorce case, and at the time of the initiation of the divorce case, he described to me what had happened in the adoption. On his behalf, I sent a letter to the attorney who handled the adoption, requested the file, and upon reviewing it, I noted some irregularities, and based upon those irregularities, I then contacted the biological father, and the motion was filed with his affidavit attached. So both fathers, the adoptive father and the biological father, have been in lockstep since the beginning of this litigation with regard to what they believe should occur with regard to the children. And that's based upon primarily the affidavit that was submitted in support of the motion for service by publication, which incidentally was done in the Lancaster Eagle Gazette, even though the biological father is a resident of Bessemer, Alabama, and has always been a resident of Bessemer, Alabama.
But my question was, the motivation of the adoptive father is to get out of the adoption so as to divest himself of support obligations.
If the court, if this case is successful, he would be relieved of that obligation. That is correct. And also, I would note that with regard to these children, he doesn't have a relationship with them. That also impacts his decision and going forward with this. He has not had a relationship with the children since the party split up.
And the weighing in on the other side would be the mother.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's correct.
And with this unusual circumstance, has there been anybody appointed to represent the interests of the children or the child?
There has not been a guardian ad litem appointed in this case, nor in the divorce case. The divorce case is really on hold until we determine what happens in this case. So the answer to that question is no. With regard to the initial—
Well, counsel, the crux of the natural father's argument is that due diligence was not exercised to notify him of the pending adoption, the termination of his parental rights, that the mother failed to disclose that, in fact, she knew where he was, and the method used was inappropriate according to statute, correct?
Correct.
And the natural father, the adoptive father, is seeking to focus on that discrepancy or that activity back in the late 90s to avoid his obligation as the parent here at this point, correct?
Those two issues do go hand in hand, Your Honor.
Okay, and the natural father, since the late 90s until this divorce proceedings 2003, had no contact with the children, didn't support the children.
Those issues were not litigated, Your Honor. That was the assertion made on behalf of the biological mother at the time of the adoption hearing. Of course, the biological father didn't have actual notice of it, and he was not there to present his case with that respect.
Has he filed anything since the adoption up until the time of this collaboration for divorce or termination of parental rights or parental status, I guess I should say? Does he have any contact with his children?
Your Honor, he would indicate that he has had contact with the children. There would be some dispute about the 1 year.
I guess the better question is, was he in court? Did he file anything? Did he, you know, do anything was his first entry into court at the behest of Mr. Walters?
To my understanding, the biological father did not file any motions in Bessemer, Alabama, with regard to the failure to have contact with his children once the mother had removed them from Alabama to Ohio.
Okay.
That's my understanding. As I indicated, the case started out on the issue of the notice, but notice by publication. The trial court denied that. We appealed, and in the appeal, we asserted an additional argument, which is the argument that is before this court on the certification of conflict, which is that the publication notice utilized by the court was incomplete because it failed to give notice of the best interest hearing. And before you ask me, I understand there's some lack of logic to that argument and because of the fact that we acknowledge that the father never had actual knowledge. It was constructive knowledge, as determined by the trial court, of the adoption proceedings.
But the exact issue before us, I don't believe we took in the issue of whether he got notice or not.
That's correct.
The issue we took in is the hearing did not notice both the consent and the best interest. It only noticed the consent.
That's correct.
So it's really a very narrow legal issue of, do you have to have both notices clearly stated, or can one be subsumed or implied in the second?
That is correct, Your Honor. And that is the conflict between now the Fifth District, which stands alone in this case, and the decisions of the Second, the First, the 12th, the Third Districts in cases that are cited in the brief. I would also point out another case that's cited in my brief, which is the Groh case out of the Seventh District. It is cited in the brief, but not for the proposition. The court in that case found that the notice was defective for other reasons, but went on in dicta to say the same thing that has been stated by the First, Second, Third, and 12th, and that has to be a separate notice of the best interest hearing.
If we follow the other jurisdictions and find that notice of one subsumes the other, what happens to this case?
Well, if you could restate your question, Your Honor, I'm not sure.
If you prevail, what happens to this case?
This case, I think what would happen would be you would remand it for a best interest hearing. That's what I believe the outcome of this particular case would be.
And the appellee agrees with you, except that the adoptive father should be a stop from arguing that he's not.
And I would acknowledge, Your Honor, that would be a significant problem if the biological father hadn't joined in the motion. The court permitted him to join in the motion, and he has been a movement since the hearing. So the biological father is still in a position to assert those issues. And again, both parties are before this court as appellants.
Well, on the legal issue, there isn't any question, is there, that the biological father is entitled under the statute to notice of the best interest hearing?
Our position is he is entitled to that notice, right? And the publication that was...
I think the appellee agrees with you. So on the legal issue, I think we have agreement, don't we? Or am I wrong? I'll ask, obviously, counsel.
I'm not sure we have an agreement on that, Your Honor.
Okay. I read his brief, I thought we did.
I suggest we might have a strong disagreement.
Okay.
The Fifth District, the way they addressed the case was to revert back to probate form 18.2, basically saying that because the publication included the salient elements of the probate form, the notification was okay. All of the other courts of appeals that have looked at that issue have gone the other way with it. They clearly indicate that there has to be at least dual notice of the consent hearing and the best interest hearing. There is a split amongst those jurisdictions as to whether there has to be separate hearings. Three of the courts, the 12th District in Taylor, the 5th District in Murphy, and the 12th District again in CMW, all these cases are in the briefs, have found that you can have one hearing as long as there is the separate notice. Now, the Murphy case, I should say, doesn't address that issue. It just says you can have one hearing on the consent issue and then go immediately to the best interest.
Do you agree with that? That the one notice would take, if one notice was public or delivered, published, et cetera, whatever the appropriate vehicle would be to get that notice out, and it contained language that encompassed both the consent and the best interest,
I am, in all honesty, Your Honor, I'm not convinced that you have to have two hearings. I believe the notice could be modified to provide, in essence, as a second part, in the event the court determines that your consent is not necessary, the court will move forward with a best interest hearing, and you are entitled to attend and participate and present evidence.
But, okay.
The cases that have determined that there must be two hearings are the Second District in the SLC case, which is a change from the earlier decision in Fenimore. Fenimore wasn't clear. SLC says there has to be two hearings. Jurgensen out of the Third District and Groh, again, out of the Seventh, but that's dicta. There's one other case that talks about it, which I will admit is not in my brief. That's the Chapman case out of the Fourth District. I understand the court's rule. But the Chapman case talks about it again in dicta and clearly references two hearings. The Chapman case is out of the Fourth District.
Technically, the certified question doesn't require us to decide that issue, but you would like us to do that for...
I think it would be appropriate to have some guidance as a practitioner in terms of how the court can handle it. Again, I believe, you know, we do much the same thing in juvenile court with adjudication and disposition that can be handled in succession. I don't know why it couldn't be done here as long as there's adequate notice. The problem is that the form that is utilized currently by the courts of appeals doesn't include anything about probate court does not include that language with regard to the best interest hearing.
Counsel, let me ask this. 3107.14, which is the hearing itself, C talks about at the conclusion of the hearing, the court is to make both determinations. That is, if the court determines that consent has been given or excused, and it is in the best interest of the child, then the court may proceed with the adoption. That's the essence of it as I understand it. Where do you find support for multiple hearings? And number two, where do you find support for a requirement that there be notice on the two specific points, rather than simply we're having a hearing on this petition?
Your Honor, what the cases talk about, and again, referencing the cases I just mentioned, the SLC case out of the Second District, Jorgensen out of the Third, and Groh out of the Seventh.
I understand those, but, okay, go ahead.
Under 3107.11, it says that you have to make a determination as to whether the consent is waived. If the consent is waived, then that person is entitled to 20 days notice of the best interest hearing.
I understand that, and why then does 14 seem to say that it's all done at the same hearing?
Your Honor, again, that's why I'm conceding that I'm not convinced it can't be done in one hearing as long as adequate notice is given.
And if it's done at one hearing, why wouldn't it not be sufficient notice to say we are going to have a hearing on this petition for adoption on such and such a day, and the statute tells everybody what is going to be decided?
Well, I think if you read the cases that have addressed that issue, they all talk about the paramount interest of a parent, which was discussed in the earlier case, and the fact that what we're dealing with here is a termination of parental rights, and that the parent who is the subject of the argument that their consent has been waived is entitled to strict construction of the statute. That's the interpretation that all of these cases give to it, and that the notice, therefore, has to be absolutely clear about what is going to be heard, and that even if you determine that your consent has been waived, you still have an opportunity to present evidence regarding best interests, which could sway the court the other way. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Happeny. Mr. Henninger.
Good morning, Chief Justice Moyer, Justices of this court. I am Lou Henninger. I represent Athena Walters, the biological mother, in this case, both in the adoption proceedings, the proceedings to set aside the adoption, as well as the divorce. I would offer a small dispute as to whether or not the issues of support and communication have been litigated, in that certainly evidence was adduced at trial in the probate court in the when the, on his on their motions regarding that issue. And so, for example, my recollection is the biological father testified that he had paid support in the face of a certified copy of the account from the Alabama counterpart to our child support enforcement agency, that he was $14,000 in arrear and that nothing had ever been paid since the divorce. But be that as it may, from the standpoint of my client, this is a dreadful situation. She is put to her defenses in her relatively impecunious state from attacks by both the biological father, who in her view did not communicate with the children for the requisite period, nor paid any child support since the date of the divorce, as well as the adoptive father, her current husband, for reasons that he claims are deficiencies in his own adoption petition, a most unusual circumstance, and as Justice Stratton points out, a strange alliance. Indeed, it has been a most difficult situation. As awful as her situation is in having to defend against these attacks, if you will, it's a very important case, as I'm sure you must appreciate, which is the reason, no doubt, you granted the conflict issue. One need not put one's ear to the ground to hear the gathering stampedes of the persons who might be affected by this, by the resolution of this issue in favor of the appellant. Certainly, either parent, any adoptive parent, man or woman, might have reason later on to question the, to assert that the judgment of the adoption decree was void based upon such a resolution. And that happens. I mean, it's unreal what some of these parents do after an adoption. I've had one parent.
Well, could we deal for a moment with what we have in front of us?
Okay.
I didn't vote to take this in, and it sure seems to me that maybe all three don't have clean hands. Your client probably lied to her lawyer about whether or not she knew the whereabouts of the father. These other two are trying to get out of supporting children, and we're being dragged into the middle of it. But as you point out, if we write anything on this, then it's going to have an effect on other folks. So what, when one knows, at least as alleged, where your ex-husband is, should you be able to get away with just publishing in a local newspaper half a country away?
Well, Justice Pfeiffer, I don't think that's my understanding of this. I'll certainly respond to your question, but my understanding of this proceeding is that was not the issue.
Right.
But the first response I would have to your assertion that she lacks clean hands, that was the litigated, one of the issues litigated in trial. And the trial court did not so find. So, I mean, there was ample evidence.
So we don't have to deal with that. We can assume that she's in the clear.
The trial court so found. The principal issue here is, my understanding.
Whether or not you have to notify twice.
Right. My basic argument here, to get right to the nuts of it, is the this is an adoption proceeding. We have to understand what's concerned in an adoption. In an adoption, the consent of both parents is required. So the statute very niftily and cleverly and elegantly says that, well, we'll first decide whether or not the consent of a parent is there. It's either there or it's not. And under the course of the two exceptions, whether or not there's been the 1 year period during which no support has been made or no communication. If the consent is not there, if the consent is not required, I'm sorry, then that is a determination that the liberty interest of the parent has been surgically cut off, if you will, by virtue of their legal abandonment of the child. Now, this abandonment thing is not some minor matter. This is enormous. As the cases point out, this is an objective standard that's used, but certainly once that's been done, that parental interest is gone. There is no protected liberty interest, as I understand the law, both in looking at the U.S. federal cases and even two cases from this court that needs to be protected in any determination or even a separate hearing in regard to the best interest of the child.
But the statute does give that parent the right to have notice about the best interest determination. You don't disagree with that, do you?
It says the hearing on the petition.
Yeah, which is
a generic statement, and the cases that seem to hold, Chief Justice, that there has to be some specific notice of the best interest hearing itself given in the notice. I don't quite understand the reasoning. I believe what it says is that fundamental fairness requires it, and some of them simply engraft it.
Well, your brief on page 13, you say appellee contends that it would be in the best interest of the children, in this case, father, that the father be given the opportunity he claimed that he'd been denied, that is, to be notified of and permitted to attend the best interest hearing.
In the event it's remanded, isn't that it?
Well, then you go on to say, to this end, the matter should be remanded for further proceedings and the adoption petition. And then that's when you say that the appellant, adoptive father, should be stopped from asserting the contrary, that it's
right
in the best interest of children to be.
Well, if it's not clear in my brief, I apologize, but it's certainly my position that, in fact, the statute does not require a separate specific notice of the best interest hearing.
Yeah, it doesn't. You do not say that. I mean, I agree.
Mm-hmm.
But,
okay.
But he does have a legal right to be notified somehow, I guess.
Yes.
Have you ever seen or heard of the parent being cut off because of the failure to support or contact, and then the adoption being denied on the second stage, best interest?
I can't think of a case that I have had where that has occurred, and the reason is this, as I have also pointed out somewhere in these briefs, of course, the probate court causes an investigation to be made, and in many courts, it's extremely thorough and quite an expensive mm-hmm. process, and look into whether or not this adoption should be granted. So, normally, by the time of the first hearing in which the issue of consent is the necessity of consent is determined, the court has before it a report based upon an investigator that they appoint to let the court know whether there's a criminal record and the mm-hmm. relationships of the parties and the suitability of the home and all of those various issues that go to the best interests of the child. And therefore, it's kind of a done deal, if you will, by
that
time.
I suppose you could have a scenario where the parent, even though they failed to support a contact, could stand up in a best interest hearing and present evidence that the court may have not been aware of, that the adopting parent, step-parent or whatever, has some issues that is against the best interest of the child. I mean, I assume that would be the purpose.
Well, the one case mentions that. I would submit that their right to do so is cut off by the fact that they don't have a protected liberty interest at that hearing.
Well, then why give them any notice of a best interest hearing if they have no ability to participate in it?
Well, that's what the stat, because it's part of the adoption proceeding, and they have the right to a notice of the adoption proceeding. That would be my argument.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense? What you're saying?
Well, if the statute says they have a right to be at the, even we can put aside how they're noticed, they have a right to be at the best interest hearing. That's one of their rights that they retain.
I don't think it says that.
You don't think that the parent has any right to be at a best interest hearing?
No, I don't.
Then why notice them?
Because that's part of the proceeding. You almost have to do it, because if the determination, of course, here's the, again, we go back to the fundamental nature of what an adoption is. If it's obviously if it's determined that the consent is needed, then there can't be a best interest hearing. There will not be one, right? And if it's not needed, then if the best interest has nothing to do with them, it has to do with the child.
That's what I'm saying, though. They could still stand up and present evidence that the child should not be adopted by this person, even though their rights have been cut off. But if you say that they have no right to do anything at this hearing in which they're required to be notified, it's a meaningless notification. It has no purpose.
Well, the right that they have to notice is of the adoption petition, and that's what the adoption petition notice form 18, whatever it is, in fact, does. I have not asserted, to my knowledge, that they have a right to be at that hearing.
Okay, so you say that the best interest really is not, even though they have a right to be notified of it, it really doesn't concern them.
I believe that's correct. It is not a protected liberty interest of the biological parent.
Although when we talk of due process, we talk not only of notice, we talk about opportunity to be heard. I mean, the two go together. I have another question. On the five cases that the Fifth District has certified as in conflict, were any of them, did any of them actually vacate an adoption as a result?
I don't recall.
Okay.
I don't recall. In response to the first part of your statement or question, I understand that fundamental due process requires not only notice, but the opportunity to be heard. But my argument undercuts that assertion in that if they have no liberty interest to be protected, they do not need to be afforded due process for it. I mean, that's...
Then why have the notice at all?
Because it's a part of the adoption. They have to be notified of the adoption proceeding.
But it's meaningless. It's meaningless in your view, though.
It is meaningless at the point in time at which their parental interest is terminated. It is not meaningless at the point in time in which they were given notice.
So, Counsel, you're saying that if their consent is found to be unnecessary, they are not entitled to step forward and dispute the best interest of the child.
That's correct. And, in fact, that's my
But
experience.
A stranger, anybody can dispute the best interest of the child. It doesn't... Because you terminate the parental right, you know, I understand that the home study is done and the information is before the referee or the magistrate to do this adoption, but if somebody steps forward and gives information to the court that there's a reason why this adoption should not take place, and it's not based on the natural parent whose rights have been terminated, trying to relitigate the first part or the first step that needs to be taken place, that is the termination of their rights or the determination of whether the consent is necessary, where does it say that they are precluded then from offering advice to the or information, should they have it?
I don't think they would be. They could certainly talk to the investigator, and I don't mean to make an inadequate response in that regard. That certainly doesn't address your principal concern, but it addresses part of it. I would only point out to you that in two cases, one from the United States Supreme Court and I think two cases from this court, it has been pointed out that who wants to listen to that person who has not performed his parental duties? In Holcomb, which is, I don't think cited in any of the briefs, it's 18 Ohio State 3rd, 361 at... it's probably dicta, but it's in the, given the interpretation of it, that the, a parent who has legally abandoned his or her child is not a person to be heard from as to the child's best interest. Now, I hope the court appreciates that in these proceedings, the child is normally there. And so the circumstance that you might find yourself in would be to have have the abandoning parent stand there and say, well, the adoptive parent's a bad guy or bad woman, and in the presence of the child. So I mean, it's a very dicey situation. And in most of the courts that I practice in where this issue arises, I've had the trial judge routinely dismisses the parent whom he or she has found their consent not to be necessary. Because, and in Lair, as in Holcomb, and I think the other case was one cited by Mr. Happney, if I pronounce the Zash case. So I think it mentions this same issue. So this court, Justice Wright, speaking for the majority in the Holcomb case, has, in analyzing the evidentiary standard, to analyze the case in that way. They're out. When that determination is made, they're out. But that's the nature of the adoption. And I would urge that position on the court.
Thank you, Mr. Henninger.
Thank you.
Mr. Happeny, you've saved 8 seconds, but take 30.
First of all, with regard to the question about the second part of the hearing, the consent specifically refers to without justifiable cause, and there's a body of case law which has evolved which defines that. There could very well be circumstances where a parent is unable to meet that without justifiable cause standard, but would still have evidence to present to the court, which would influence the court with regard to the best interests of the children. All of these cases, in answer to your question, Your Honor, the five cases, actually six, that were cited vacated the adoptions. The other two that I cited also vacated the adoptions, but they vacated because of other defects, and then the issue regarding the hearing notice with regard to the best interest hearing was dicta. But all eight of these cases vacated the adoptions. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.